You got it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we got it.
Okay. 1, 2, 3. Hi, we're fans of Undisclosed, and you're listening to Undisclosed Live.
Perfect.
You can take that out, though, right?
One, two, three, four, five. Hi, this is Susan Simpson with Undisclosed Live at the fifth and almost certainly, well, certainly final day of Anand's PCR hearing. I'm at the Duncan. It is 9:29. Technically, court's at 9:30, but we haven't started on time yet this week, so I think I got some wiggle room here. It is snowing. It's really pretty, but the court's still open, so that works out fine. Most likely, I think we'll just hear closing arguments today. I'm very curious to see what both sides come out with. Things have gone very well. I think the team did an amazing job, and they, you know, their job here was to put on the best case they could. That's all they could control, and they did that. And I called Doug Colbert last night. He left the court, I think, before the last witness, and he wanted me to give him an update. Doug Colbert was Anand's attorney for the bail hearing back in '99, along with Chris Floor. So I called him, and we were talking about what happened, and I was saying, I think I feel optimistic, and I hate that. I never, as a litigator, I'm never optimistic, and I, as a rule, I will not be. And I was saying, I don't want to be optimistic, but I kind of can't help it. And he said, be hopeful, not optimistic. And that made a lot of sense to me, because I am feeling hopeful right now. And you never know what's going to happen. Things can always happen in court you don't expect. But I feel hopeful. And let's go see what they have for closings.
Hi, this is Rabia. Welcome to day 5 of Anand's reopened PCR hearing. We are doing undisclosed live updates of the hearing. And today, there's some big news, right? Only big news because I was unsequestered for the closing arguments, which is nice. It was really great to finally be in there and to hear Justin and to hear Tharu and see Adnan. And he saw me a number of times, smiled, waved. So I think he's also kind of relieved that I got a chance to at least be in there, you know, show my support. So I'm going to give a brief kind of overview of what went down. It is lunchtime right now, but we are not done yet. Justin gave about a little over an hour long closing remarks. And Justin gave I thought it was a really tight closing argument. He kind of went over the issues again. He made the point clear over and over that much of what the prosecution was offering was speculation without any evidence to back it up. For example, he mentioned over and over how there were no witnesses presented to make the prosecution's case. For example, if the prosecution's making the case that Gutierrez met her duty by not, you know, even though she failed to call Asia as an alibi witness, he didn't present a single evidence to testify that. He didn't present any...
You mean questions from the prosecutor as an evidence?
Oh, no, well, question. I think the prosecutor's stories are cute and everything, and, you know, his hypotheses and theories are great. I mean, I feel like I've heard it all kind of, though. Don't they sound really familiar, Susan?
They've got some new ones. They definitely have some new ones. Give them credit.
What new ones? I've seen them all on Reddit. I saw them months ago. What new ones?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, new for them. I mean...
I don't know, we'll
get into it. There really were points where everyone's always like, oh, I bet he's going to steal his arguments from Reddit. I'm like, that's stupid. Of course he's not going to. And there were points today I was like, wait, did he actually steal this from Reddit?
Yeah.
Only he didn't, because Reddit gets more right than he does.
Anyhow, I'm going to let Susan talk more about the closing that Justin gave. Tharu was still going on with his closing.
Oh, yeah. Probably add that. And the reason we're at lunch during closing arguments is because Tharu's has gone on that long.
Yeah, he put up some foam boards, really pretty stuff. He had some slides. The thing that was interesting is that it took a long time for him to actually get to the issues that are being litigated. He started with a real long summary of this was the evidence in the case. And almost like he wants to kind of just remind... Well, he was. I understand why he was doing it. He was talking about the second prong of Strickland, which is that you have to show that...
That's what he said he was doing.
I mean, I kind of get it. And the only reason he can do that is because he can't show the first one. I think it's clear that Gutierrez failed her duty. So now you have to prove that by failing her duty, there was some impact, some prejudice to Adnan. So what he's trying to do...
I think he's telling the judge, look, if you're going to do what you might do here, you're letting a cold-hearted murderer of a young girl go free. And he's like reminding him as often as possible, Your Honor, you do this, you're letting this murderer go free.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like to be.
Yeah, it is. It is just a recital of, like, it's almost like the closing from the first trial in a way. It's interesting. Anyhow, okay, I'll let Susan take over so she can get to the meat and potatoes on her 85 pages of notes.
Yeah. My hand actually is starting to hurt today. So I'm trying to get as much of it down, like, word for word as possible so I can quote their lovely phrases. And, well, so far I'm keeping up. Justin's closing was really good. Like, it was sound. It was just well organized. It was, like, folksy and friendly but intelligent. It hit all the points it should have hit. Very well done. I've got some quotes in here that I love that I'll find eventually. And yeah, and you know, that's like an easy answer. It was amazing and fantastic, but it really was. I don't. And I'm not just saying that because obviously I support Anand's case and I support this side of the hearing, but like it was good. Oh, I guess we did forget one thing from this morning. So ultimately happened is Abe Wernowitz didn't testify. The judge kind of wanted to be done with this, and he said he preferred to have an affidavit entered instead. So Abe made an update affidavit clarifying what Fitzgerald was trying to confuse about, no, this is what I actually said and meant. I like the way when Justin put it. He's like, read the first affidavit. It's all there. It says, I would not have testified the way I did had I seen the affidavit. And Justin said, that's engineer talk for he's recanting. And it is. Like, that's recanting in the sense that he would not have done what he did had he seen that sheet. So, on to the closings. You know, Justin points out that... he pointed out how... He said there were only two witnesses for the prosecution, and actually only one witness because Officer Steve was really our witness. He helped us, not them. So all they've got is one witness, and that's Chad Fitzgerald. And the way he said it, like, he didn't need really to go into the evasiveness and the refusal to answer. Like, I kind of just said it all. Their only witness is Chad Fitzgerald. So... we get to closing. I wasn't kidding earlier. I don't think that Theroux knows this case. Like, we're so far into it, and he still doesn't know basic facts. Like, apparently, did you know that Becky Walker testified in the first trial that she saw Hay at the school at 3 p.m.? And would have testified to that in the second trial, but didn't come out? No, that was Debbie. So he can't even keep his witnesses straight. But ignoring the name switch... Theroux brings this up as evidence that Gutierrez was considering an alternative strategy that relied on a 3 p.m. departure from school for Hay, and therefore the decision to ignore Asia was valid. Well, if that was a strategy, he just admitted that she failed to do it. So her entire strategy failed because she couldn't get a witness to make the same statement they made in a previous trial. And this is like litigating 101. It's not hard to do that. You get a witness that changes their story at a second trial, you pull up the transcript and you go, oh really? Isn't it true last time I asked you this, you said XYZ? And you get that 3 p.m. thing in. Like, there's no question she could have gotten that in, but didn't, because she was ineffective. And Theroux's up there going, look, it's proof of how diligent she was. She had a different strategy. Well, if that was her strategy, and it wasn't, it doesn't matter, because she totally failed to do it. So, I mean, it's all... it might be unfair to say he's all over the place. People are shaking their heads. Okay, so...
are you talking about Theroux?
Yeah.
He's telling a rambling story, but I was like, get to the issues. And I think because he doesn't have a lot to say on the issues. I mean,
he's told us all the ways in which... well, not all of them correct, but all the ways in which Anand has killed Hay. Anand killed Hay. Like, that's all he's doing up there, or was doing. He's finally, just before lunch, started to get more into the actual issues at the PCR hearing. Not a trial here. You don't need to argue. You don't give a closing about how guilty the guy is at a PCR hearing. My favorite thing is he made this lovely little chart of all the letters Gutierrez was sending to the prosecutors trying to obtain evidence. And, like, look how diligent she was. That's proof of how much... discovery-dodging jerks the prosecutors were being. Because, yes, she did write lots and lots of letters trying to get evidence because the prosecutors weren't giving him any. And he says, oh, they had an open file policy and she could have gotten anything she wanted. If the prosecutor's office had an open file policy like they're claiming, then she could have just gone there once, copied stuff out of the file, and not written, like, two dozen letters being like, Yurik, give me the documents you should have given me months ago. Yurik, give me the documents. Over and over again. So, like, that's his grand proof that Gutierrez was diligent. It's further proof that his claims about the open file policy are bogus, because, again, you can't, I'm like, one sentence in your closing be all, oh, it's open file policy, so any of this Brady speculation is meritless because she could have gotten in and got our files. And then the next sentence say, look how diligent Gutierrez was because she wrote all these letters demanding that the prosecutors give her evidence. Like, which is it? Was she diligent, or were the prosecutors hiding evidence? And he said, I mean, I feel like I have a unique perspective on this closing because I know all these documents by heart. So I know before he brings them up what he's talking about. And he is misrepresenting the hell out of them. And it's, no one's ever going to be able to call him on it because, like, you'd have to, like, look at, I mean, in a closing, you can't do it. Because we're not even having a closing argument, are we?
This is not a closing argument. He's completely inaccurate in some places. And it's just, it is just literally like, and I don't, that's what I keep wondering, is I don't know if Justin could do a rebuttal. But then how long do you keep going back in circles over and over again?
Justin will do a very tight rebuttal, hit some of the bigger absurdities, and walk away. But so with Thiru, I now know why the state arrested yesterday and called no more witnesses. Because Thiru is their witness. His little binder trick where he got two binders admitted into evidence, one containing the MPIA, one containing the defense file, without, like, getting individual documents admitted, means he can now, on closing, pull out random docs we've never seen before, ever, in the course of this hearing, and be like, here's more proof of what I'm saying. So the two binders of evidence, binders A and B, A is the defense file, well, A is selected portions of the defense file, B is selected portions of the state's file, but mostly just the MPIA, which Gutierrez didn't even have, so. And at first, Thiru would try to get them both admitted. Justin objected. The court kind of delayed. I think by day two, he was like, I can all come in. So everything's now on the record. And that's why in closing, you can see the prosecutor randomly pulling up new documents and making arguments about them. That's not a closing thing. In closing, you discuss the evidence, what was already done. You don't bring up new ass files that no one's ever heard of and be like, I'm going to explain to you now why this shows that she wasn't ineffective. So it's new evidence in that respect. And Justin said in his closing, why didn't they put one attorney on the stand who would be willing to say that what Gutierrez did is fine, or that her files don't show an attorney who is falling apart at the seams? Well, the answer is they did find one attorney willing to say that. Thiru. Apparently the only attorney in Baltimore who was willing to make such a crazy claim. We are outside of the courthouse in the end of the PCR hearing. As predicted, the court did not issue a ruling. It will issue a written opinion, likely in a couple months. So now we wait. That was a longer day for just having closings to go through than I expected. But Thiru's closing did eventually end. Eventually. I don't even know how long it went on for. After we recap the entire body of evidence in this case, well, the entire body of evidence that helps the prosecution, Justin, in his rebuttal, wrote down the exact same thing I wrote down of what Thier was saying, and that was after he goes on this long tirade about all this evidence that could somehow maybe possibly show, oh, look, he's holding a press conference over there. Sorry, I just noticed that Thier was sitting there with all the press around him. After Thier goes through his whole long spiel about, oh, maybe, possibly, Adnan was soliciting an alibi from Asia with a complicated conspiracy with Juwan and Justin and all these people. He's like, I don't know. It's just a theory. And Justin said in his opening, he quoted the case law. It says, you cannot defeat a claim. Like you have to have evidence showing strategy. Speculation by a prosecutor is not evidence and is not sufficient to show that an attorney made a reasonable choice in not taking a particular strategy. And then Thiru's like, I'm going to speculate on a bunch of stuff here. I mean, I know that my opponent just quoted the case law saying speculation isn't evidence, but that's all I got, so I guess I'm going to roll with it. And you know? And Justin, just on his rebuttal, took him to the cleaners on that. Rightfully so, because as much as Thiru's up there pointing out all these, like, documents and rummaging through the defense files and suggesting that there were things that could be linked together to show some grand, really convoluted and kind of nonsensical theory of a conspiracy. And then Justin's like, okay, great. Then you should have gotten a witness up here to say that. The fact you couldn't get a witness to say it means it's not in the record. Because apparently, Theroux is the only attorney in all of Baltimore willing to go on the record with this theory of why Gutierrez was competent. Like, so here's Theroux's idea. Theroux's idea is that Adnan intentionally used Jay to be his alibi witness for the murder. His other idea is that Adnan did not know on March 9th that Jay was a state's witness and thought they were still on Adnan's side. These two ideas cannot be reconciled because if Adnan's sitting there planning to use Jay as his alibi witness and then gets arrested and has no idea that Jay is turned against him, then why did he never mention Jay as his alibi? Like, you don't spend all this time crafting an alibi and then not use it when you're arrested? No. I don't know what I just witnessed, because it's like someone like printed off a bunch of random Reddit posts and like read them out of order. Maybe like started reading random comments too. Because I just didn't, he didn't know the facts. Like, he got simple things wrong over and over again about like who said what or what dates things happened on. Like, just, you know, I mean, I guess not huge in the scheme of things, but the fact you don't even know which witness said what is kind of a big deal when you're the prosecutor in a major PCR hearing. And when you're conveying these facts to the judge. And also, as Justin called him out at the very end, which was kind of fantastic, he didn't just call out Theroux. He called out Kevin Urich. Justin got up there on rebuttal and said, and he says, I have a few points to make, and he goes through them. And I think it's like a third or fourth one. He says, Mr. Urich. Talks about how Urich has a long history with this case and is relevant to it. He said, like, I don't know if it was in this courtroom last time around. And the judge cuts in and is like, actually, it was two courts down. And then Justin says, Urich got on the stand and said all this about Asia being pressured into writing an affidavit. And he said, at this hearing today, this week, a large body of evidence has been presented that indicates what Kevin Urich said is not true. And that should scare every person in this courtroom. The state's being pretty brazen, because if you're going to stand by that, what Kevin Urich said, then you bring Kevin Urich in here and put him on the stand. Boom. Like, enough said. Like, I was saying, I don't even know, someday, at some point, they're all blurring together. What Asia said makes Kevin Urich a liar. And if you have a witness on the stand saying that a prosecutor for Baltimore lied about what she told him on the stand in a PCR hearing, then if you believe that no wrongdoing was done here, and if you stand by your prosecutor, you put him on the goddamn stand. I'm sorry. The fact that they didn't call him shows that they're terrified of what Asia McClain said. And they do not stand by their case, because put Kevin Urich up. Because, you know what? I know why they didn't put Kevin Urich up, because we would have destroyed him. Like, oh, things we didn't get to use now because Kevin Urich didn't testify. Guess what? Asia's not the only witness that he tried to prevent from talking about the case. He did a similar thing with Abe Wernowitz, because I was talking to Abe and asking him for questions about the case and the cell phone evidence. And when Urich found out, he wrote a very tersely worded letter to Abe saying, you shouldn't be talking to anyone about it because it's just going to cause a lot of stress for you if you do so, so you shouldn't be doing that. And it worked. Abe got scared off for a while. So with Asia, it's not the first time, or at least not the only time, where he's done this kind of thing. There's a lot of reasons they did not put Urich on the stand. But still, if they believed in their case, they would have. They had this other idea too, that, oh, maybe Asia was a genuine alibi. Maybe she was being honest. After we just spent an hour describing why she's a lying liar who lies, maybe she was honest. Maybe everything she said was true. But that doesn't matter, because maybe that's just part of the murder. Maybe Anand got Hay outside the library at 3 o'clock, and that's why you couldn't use the library alibi, because it was actually part of the murder plan. Well, you know what? Doesn't matter, because the state committed to its stupid 230 murder theory, and Asia destroys that. So this speculation about when a different murder might have occurred that totally contradicts the state's case has no bearing in what the court is considering now.
Hi, we're back, and it is the end of the day. We are in Justin Brown's offices, and I'm going to pick up telling you guys what happened after lunch, which is the last time I checked in. We headed back to the courthouse, and actually closing arguments had resumed. The prosecutor, Thiruvigna Raja, had begun, he was resuming his closing arguments, which were quite long. I think he must have gone on for more than 2.5 hours. What was interesting to me was that much of it was spin and just argument, but he wasn't really addressing the issues head on, and the issues very specific. So he would even take, for example, the facts. I mean, with Asia, he kept trying to draw attention to, instead of addressing the issue of whether or not it was okay for Christina not to contact her, he started talking about, oh, this is all the evidence. And I'm not gonna lie, honestly, I feel like every single thing like we've seen on Reddit for the last year from the people who feel Adnan is guilty, like literally like this is a recital of their arguments. So the ridiculous things like, you know, the note, the breakup note from like the previous November, and getting a cell phone from 2 days before. And he just was making a case. He was making a case like he was at trial or something. And it was like, get to the issues in front of you, which are facts cover sheet and how that would have impacted the testimony of the expert. And Asia not being contacted, but he just would dance around it a lot. So I guess the argument he was trying to make was that Asia, even if Asia had appeared, it wouldn't have mattered because there was such overwhelming evidence. Now, what was great was that Justin was fantastic. I mean, so his closing just went on and on. And I mean, we were really getting exhausted. And the judge finally said, you need to wrap it up. And then we had a break. Justin Brown came back. And he also misrepresented some things. I mean, like, for example, he misrepresented. He came up with this crazy theory, which Justin very justifiably called it a conspiracy theory. And he's right. It's total conspiracy. He came up with this theory that maybe Gutierrez didn't contact Asia because she knew that that would actually help the state's case, because she thought that Hay had last been seen at 3 p.m. What was hilarious was that he kept referencing the testimony of Debbie. He's saying, you know, these witnesses testify that she was seen around 3, but they testified later. I mean, like, we're talking about, you know, mistakes she made way before trial, right? So how could she look in the future and say, you know, this is what the witnesses are going to do? But so he had this really odd theory that this might have been part of it. And he said, part of that theory was, he said that, you know, Christina knew that going to the library was not part of Adnan's general routine. And so she didn't want to touch it, because then she would have to explain why all of a sudden on the day this girl, you know, disappeared, he fell out of routine. So he pulls up a document in which I think there were some handwritten notes, and I think Adnan had told either paralegal or Tina that, you know, school, track, practice, mosque, right? And it was so disingenuous, because when Justin did his rebuttal, and I'm so glad Justin did it, he went bam, and he took the same document, pulled it up a little bit, and on the same document it said, often goes to library. I mean, and Justin not only pointed out how disingenuous, and really he's like, he's making total misrepresentations to the court, right? Like, he's trying to pull the wool over this judge's eyes and everybody's sitting there by just not sliding the document up further. So, but what was great about it was Justin didn't just point that out. He said we should be scared of prosecutors doing things like this. And he's right, we should. Because we are dealing with systematic issues in the system, that they have so much power they can do this. Justin said very clearly, and I thought this was fantastic, he looked right at him and he said, I resent you for, not you, but I resent the insinuations, because he kept implying that Justin somehow had manipulated the cell phone evidence, and God, Justin's like one of the most ethical people I've ever met. And so Justin was like, you know, I resent it. He repeated it a couple times, and I thought that was really strong. And I mean, he just was like, all of this stuff that the prosecutor's saying, he's like, this is the prosecutor. It's his argument. This is not evidence. There's a difference between evidence and argument, right? Like, so, for example, if he's going to offer the theory that this is maybe what Adnan did this, maybe he did this, put somebody on the witness stand who's going to testify to that. If you're going to say what Tina did was okay, put somebody in the stand to testify to that. Where's your evidence? Your evidence has to be documents. It has to be testimony, right? It can't just be this is what the prosecutor thinks. And really, the only person who actually kind of testified from the state was the prosecutor himself, you know? But it's not even considered evidence because it's not testimony. It's just rhetoric. So he BS'd himself, you know, through 4 or 5 days. He just BS'd, you know, all through it. That's what I think the state. I don't think the state has much going on. I don't think they have a leg to stand on. Justin gave a very tight, short rebuttal. It was brutal. It was like, let's pare this down. These are the issues. This is what happened. It's simple. It's not as complicated as this guy's making it. when the judge wrapped up, I almost thought he was going to make, like, a render a decision, because he kind of, like, leaned forward and said thank you. I'm like, oh, my God, he's going to make a decision. But then he said, you know, I'm going to, like, give a written decision. We actually think it'll probably be in the next few weeks, I think month or so, which is pretty quick for a post-conviction, but the judge is retired, and it's the only case he's handling, and he knows there's a lot of people waiting on this decision, so we hope for a good result.
Hi to the internet. Are you Periscoping?
That was a joke.
I'll tell you.
This is
hashtag Feel the Brown.
Feel the Brown. God. This was let me talk about that a little bit, because this was the first time Chris and I have worked on the same case before, representing co-defendants, but this is the first time that we have essentially tried a case side by side together. I thought Chris was phenomenal. His cross of the security guard, if I had done that, it would have been a disaster, because my style is very different from his. I was very proud of him. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So can you just tell me a little bit about how you're feeling right now? Are you?
I'm tired. It's been a long 5 days. We have worked. You know, we've been working like about 15 hours a day. I think I took a little bit of time off on Saturday, and I watched a little bit of the Super Bowl, but I haven't been sleeping. We have been preparing for every possible scenario of what could have happened at the hearing. So the stuff that you saw in the hearing is literally the tip of the iceberg. I think about, you know, a couple of days into it, we started, well, probably actually on the first day, we started to figure out what their strategy was going to be. And once we figured that out, we started to try to move in front of them and kind of be a step ahead of them. And I think we did a pretty good job of that. So there wasn't a time when we were surprised by anything. And I think, you know, that's a big part of being successful in this type of setting, is that you've just got to be one step ahead of your opponent. Right. The state strategy was to try to take the defense file, which they had and which we couldn't keep away from them, and to try to use that against us and to build possible reasons why Gutierrez would not have contacted Asia. And, you know, the best way for them to do it, and this is what I said in my closing arguments, is if they had really solid theories that would have alleviated Gutierrez of her duty to investigate, then what they should have done is put an expert witness on to endorse those theories. But without any live testimony supporting what they were saying, everything was empty. And I think that they couldn't find someone who's going to say that. I don't think they could find a criminal defense attorney in good standing and of good repute who would say that a criminal defense attorney does not have the duty to go out and interview an alibi witness. That's what I think. I think there is some truth to that argument, that it's our burden. Right, so we presented our case first, and we have to prove our points. It's up to us. If we do nothing, then we lose. If the state does nothing, they might lose and they might win. So in a technical sense, that is correct, that he doesn't have any burden and he doesn't have to put on any witnesses if he doesn't want to. Now, that said, if you want to win a very hotly contested proceeding like this, it can often be advantageous to put on witnesses. So, you know, they did put on a couple witnesses, and you know, it's their strategy. I don't, you know, it is what it is. I believe that. There are certain standards that attorneys have to maintain in their practice. And the standards, in my opinion, and this is Justin Brown speaking, but the standards, particularly for a prosecutor, are probably higher than they are for example, criminal defense attorneys. And they have an obligation as prosecutors and as representatives of the state to do things in a manner that is fair and in a manner that presents the truth with some accuracy. And I have a problem when prosecutors present information in a manner that they know to be inaccurate, and that if it is done with the intention of deceiving the court, then I have a problem with that. Now, that said, you know, it's very possible that those were innocent mistakes, and he had not seen the documents that fully fleshed out whatever fact he was trying to establish. But you know, I to me, stuff like that's important. And when I see something that makes me think those rules are not being abided by, it concerns me. And as I said in court, it scares me. Twitter, I don't know a whole lot about it. I was accused of tweeting about the security guard, Steve, falsely. I never tweeted anything about it, but I think the other side understands Twitter less than I do, which is somewhat remarkable. And I was falsely accused of tweeting about him, which I never did. But I think it's fascinating. And, you know, Periscope and all this stuff, it's like, it just, as a former journalist, I truly appreciate the significance of it and how it changes the way that things are covered. You know, this is a very challenging hearing to cover because cameras are not allowed in the courtroom. And I just spoke with someone a minute ago who just said, you know, well, I wasn't there, but I followed the hearing. I'm like, how in the world did you follow the hearing? Were people violating the judge's orders and tweeting from the courtroom or recording things? He's like, no. They run outside, people tweet something, and then there's a feed you can watch on Reddit. Yeah. So maybe when I go home tonight, I'll check it out. But it's fun, and I think it's great, and I have tried to embrace it, you know, and try to get out in front of it rather than, you know, be the guy falsely accusing other lawyers of doing things that they didn't do.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I drove here from New Jersey because I was a really big fan of Serial, and then I started listening to Undisclosed and consequently Truth and Justice, so I'm pretty well-versed in the whole case. So I just happened to have Monday off. I didn't catch the first couple days, so I drove here on Sunday night and I got a hotel, and I've been here for the past 2 days, and it was really, really interesting to watch. I really wanted to see, like, Justin in action because I just hearing about it wasn't, like, as satisfying in the tweets. And I thought he did a really good job. The prosecutor, he's good, too, but it's just, like Justin just said in his last comments, like, it's all hypotheticals. And, like, the difference in quality of the witnesses, like, was really apparent, I think. Like, Asia, and I didn't see her, but I heard about her. And Irwin, who I saw, was just, like they were so solid, and then hit, like, I don't even know why they put Steve on, to be quite honest. Like Justin said, like, all he did was help them. But yes, yeah, so I kind of feel like the judge is gonna, I think it's gonna go in our favor, or I say our, like, I'm a part of it, but yeah, I feel like it is gonna go in Adnan's favor.
Hi, this is Colin Miller down in South Carolina, reporting on the fifth day of the reopened PCR proceedings in the Adnan Syed case. I think it's even tougher today to go through tweets and try to figure out what happened during closing arguments than it was to figure out what happened during testimony. That said, I wanted to highlight a few things that I saw on social media. These are all tweets from Justin Fenton. The first topic is the issue of when Asia's second letter was written. We know the deputy AG has been trying to claim it was after the actual date of March 2nd. According to Justin Fenton, quote, Asia's second letter was written to BCDC, where Syed would have been weeks later, and included information from search warrant not known until later, he says. I've already covered before how the information in Asia's second letter was out there in the news, both the Baltimore Sun and TV news reports. In terms of Adnan being at BCDC not until weeks later, that's simply incorrect. I have here a letter that was sent from Chris Floor, one of Adnan's bail attorneys, and I'm reading for it. I respectfully request permission that my investigator, Andrew Davis, accompany me to see my client this morning at 9 a.m. My client is Adnan Syed, ID number 99200-5477, located in R35. He is a juvenile in protective custody. Thank you. Then fast forward to January 14th, 2000, so almost a year later, we have a letter being sent to Adnan at BCDC, Baltimore City Detention Center. He's still in protective custody. He still has the same ID number. He is still in the same wing, R35. And that argument about this letter possibly being written later based upon a change in location weeks later, simply not true. At least as early as March 4th, he is in the same location he's in January of the next year. Next, we have another tweet by Justin Fenton noting how the Deputy Attorney General, quote, laid out how Jay and Adnan had built a careful alibi, calling people being seen certain places. A billing log for Syed's private investigator shows him contacting all of those people in the initial period after arrest. Again, that's simply not true. The calls that afternoon were after Nisha to Patrick, they were to Phil, they were to Jen. The person they supposedly saw early that evening was not her real name, Kathy. None of those people were investigated by the PI in the initial period after arrest. The only person on the call log that afternoon who was contacted by the PI was Nisha. And what do we know about Nisha? Nisha has consistently said in every documented interview we have, whether notes or otherwise, that the call she remembers where Jay was on the phone was when Jay was working at his place of employment. In a trial, she says that is his job at the adult video store. We know on January 13th, Jay didn't have any job. He didn't have any job until weeks later. He didn't have the adult video store job until the end of January. So unless Adnan could somehow see the future and try to create an alibi back on January 13th about visiting Jay at his job, despite Jay having no job and certainly not the adult video store job, it simply makes no sense that this conspiracy to concoct an alibi makes any sort of sense, and it's certainly not consistent with what the deputy AG said during closing. This third tweet by Justin says, quote, Syed's original defense counsel was seeking to exploit those people seeing Hay at the school at 3, with prosecution contention killed at 2:36 p.m. So basically what the state is trying to do here is to say there was a reasonable trial strategy of not contacting Asia McClain because the defense strategy at trial was to try to contradict the state's timeline by saying, well, wait a second, Debbie saw Hay still at school at 3, and therefore, for that defense, Asia wouldn't have been helpful and, in fact, might have been harmful. Well, what do we know? We know that other tweets have said that Justin cited to 9 cases saying it is ineffective assistance of counsel not to contact an alibi witness. And basically, these cases, including, I'm assuming, Court of Appeals of Maryland cases and Fourth Circuit cases, what they say is you can't decide upon an alibi strategy without first contacting a prospective alibi witness. Now, certainly, it could have been legitimate after talking to Asia to decide, we're not going to use that alibi, we're going to argue Debbie saw Hay at 3, and that defeats the state's timeline. Now, first of all, did Gutierrez actually do that effectively at trial? No. What do we know? We've discussed this in the podcast. It is true Debbie testified she saw Hay at 3. What we also know, though, is in the interview, Debbie said we weren't alone in that conversation. There was a third student. It was, quote-unquote, Takara. Takara asked Hay for a ride, and Hay said she couldn't give anyone a ride because she had no time. She had to pick up her cousin. Gutierrez never references this at trial, never draws out that Hay almost certainly would not be giving anyone a ride. But beyond that, which strategy sounds better to you? Going against the state's theory, the witnesses Inez, the defense witness Becky, saying Hay left school at about 2:20, and using Asia as an alibi, I saw Adnan until 2:40, well past the time that Hay would have left school, or trying to argue against the state's timeline by using one witness, Debbie, who Waffles, who changes her story and maybe does say she sees Hay at 3. Again, it's not really for us to judge because that's not the point. The point is simply this, and this is the point that Justin has driven home throughout this trial, and that is when you as defense counsel are presented with a potential alibi witness, the only way to assess that witness's credibility, to decide whether to call them or not as a part of trial strategy, the only way to do that is to contact that alibi witness to get their story, to assess their credibility, and at that point in time decide, I'm going to go with strategy A as opposed to strategy B. Didn't happen here. Overall, I think that the defense has made a strong case of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Hi, my name is Abraham Woronowitz. I was the original cell phone. I was original cell phone engineer for the trial back in 2000. And I'd like to say that prosecution put me in a really tough spot when I learned about the facts cover sheet and the legend on there and some of the other anomalies with the Exhibit 31. So I put in my affidavit for that back in October and another affidavit today for the conclusion of the hearing. In short, I do believe there are still problems with Exhibit 31 and the other documents in there, and that if the cell phone records are unreliable for incoming calls, then I cannot validate my analysis from back then. Now, what I did back then, I'm very confident that I did the right thing. I did my engineering properly, that I took measurements properly. The question is, was I giving the right thing to measure?
Oh, did you hear? According to the state's expert, you get a 3.5 out of 4 in terms of your work, and he couldn't quite give you that 4 because you didn't do drive testing.
I don't think he saw my drive test maps. I went drive testing with Yurik and Murphy and Jay. We were all in the same car, and we visited some of the spots that were on the record, some of the calls where Jay claimed they were made.
Well, thank you for being here. I mean, I know you have no dog in this fight. Your only dog in the fight is having accurate data be used. And that's why you're here today, not for the state.
To me, it's more about engineering integrity. I need to be honest with my data from beginning to end, and I can't vouch for my data if it's based on unreliable data.
So this may very well be the last update for Undisclosed Live. I'm currently sitting in a car in a parking lot because it's too cold to record outside. We just came out of Justin's office from his press conference. I'm about to head to dinner and doing one last, well, hopefully quick, update of what happened today because a lot went on. And I was asked to give a quick run through of what the end of Theo's arguments were and what Justin said in rebuttal. And I'm not even sure to start because Theory was all, like, literally from the beginning of the case. He went through, oh my gosh, he hit so much random stuff, it's done. And I feel like I have a unique perspective on that closing argument because there probably isn't anyone who knows the defense file better than I do. I know every document he's talking about, I've read every single one, so I know what he's referring to. And in his closing, he keeps saying things like, I can't give an example now, but the way he describes them makes them sound really sinister or something or somehow relevant. And I'm like, I know exactly what he's talking about, and it's nothing remotely like what he's just describing. And Justin did, I think I already talked about this, but Justin did call him out for that, which I appreciated. Because he's relying on the fact that he's flashing records on a screen really quickly, making an argument and running, and knowing that no one's going to like pull out those documents and carefully compare what he just said in court against what the document actually says. But newsflash, they don't match. What he is trying to use those documents to say is so strained. One of the many, many arguments we've heard as to why Gutierrez might not have called or talked to Asia. One was that Asia would be proof that, back up a bit. He was saying, well, Anon had a regular pattern. He only did two things after school. He only ever went to the school library, or not even that, because that was earlier in the day. He was like, Anon only ever went to track and then to the mosque, or he went and had sex with Hay and then went to track and then to mosque. Those were the only two routines he ever had. So therefore, if Asia comes in and testifies, she would show that given that Anand only has two possible routines he ever engages in. He wasn't doing the first one, which means he was doing the going to Best Buy with hay routine. Come on, high schoolers don't have one of two routines they always follow every day. That's not how the world works. But more importantly, as I think I mentioned earlier, the attorney's own notes of this conversation with Anand say, went to library often, the public one we're talking about here. So Gutierrez could not have believed that Anand only had two routines that consisted of either going to straight to track or to Best Buy and then to track, because her own information shows one of his routines included going to the public library. Just like the 20 minutes later thing, I think it was one of the first days of the trial, he said, look at this paper showing she contacted track teammates. And this one says 20 minutes late. It means that Anand was 20 minutes late to practice and it was damaging to his alibi. And that's why she didn't try harder. But that was the same witness that she did subpoena, never talked to. Subpoenaed him to show up. So one, pretend theory makes sense. That's what the note says. She still went ahead and subpoenaed him for the defense case. And let's go back to the fact that note says never spoke to that track teammate. So given the note is very clear, she never spoke to him. How'd she learn that Anand was 20 minutes late? But the actual answer is that it has nothing to do with track at all. If you read the whole note, it says something like, call this track team member, left message, 20 minutes later, his father called back. Like, that's all it says. And he's up there going, oh, Anand was 20 minutes late to track practice. It proves Jay right. Although Jay has Anand like an hour late, so whatever. So I was during one of the bench conferences, I tried to go through and pull out some of my favorite theory quotes. I've got, this is really inspiring for the state. Even for the state to see so many people come behind the defendant. And probably the best one of all, in arguing that the post-conviction should be denied, this is an opportunity to restore a bit of faith in the system. Dude, really? Really? We restore faith in the system by turning down a PCR hearing in which a prosecutor was accused of perjury and then failed to take the stand to defend himself? Restoring faith in the system is affirming that conviction? That's so tone deaf. Like, and what he was talking about, that should explain, is that, defendant shouldn't get too many bites of the apple. It undermines our system if someone can keep litigating things and keep raising these claims. So maybe we should restore a little bit of faith in the system by not allowing Anand to do this here. And he said things like, the state doesn't take a position based on what's popular in the moment. Like, all you silly little fans out there, you're just doing it because it's a fad, not because you're at all concerned about the justice system. Anyway, going back to more theory quotes. Long before Gutierrez fought for her life, she fought even harder for Mr. Syed. And then talking about Asia, the defense would have you believe that, like, Asia magically appeared all these years later, that she was a diamond in the rough, mined out of some dark cave. There were more flowery ones I probably have somewhere in my main notes. But there would be, you know, the way he writes, very florid, very soap opera-y, he talks that way too. So, at one point during closing arguments today, we have Thiru flash on his little screen, his big screen actually, one of the pages of the February 17th facts, which was the first subscriber activity report sent over, the more subscriber activity report, as Thiru would have it. I'm doing air quotes right now. he shows the top and says, oh, look, it says here, fax sent on, date, and like some other numbers and fax header stuff. So look, everyone was on notice that this was a fax that was sent over. Huh. And Justin didn't argue this because, why follow Thiru's stupid arguments? There are so many. But come on, this one, he's up there saying everyone should have known that this Exhibit 31 document was a fax machine and therefore, a fax document, and therefore Gutierrez did know or should have known about the cover sheet and there was no Brady violation. Here's the deal. You know what happened with that exhibit? The AT&T documents that were sent to AT&T for verification are not the same documents that were ultimately admitted as Exhibit 31 at trial. The documents that AT&T verified are a different set. So Kevin Urich sent four pages of records to AT&T to verify the affidavit. And he then took that affidavit and put it in court with a different version of the phone records. And I'll post a picture online to explain it better. But what happened is the documents sent to AT&T to verify do have fax information that show all the sheets were faxed. It's like a little fax header thing at the edges of it. And it's like, this is a fax. So AT&T verified one set that clearly shows it's a fax. We get to trial. We get to Exhibit 31. It's a different set of documents with all the fax cutters, with all the fax headers cut off. I'm sure if he was asked, Kevin Urich would claim, oh, I found a set of documents that were easier to read or something. I don't even know what he'd claim. But the fact remains, Kevin Urich submitted documents as authenticated copies when they were not authenticated copies. He switched out the records that AT&T authenticated for his own preferred version of the documents. And the preferred version of the documents just happened not to have a fax header on them. It still drives me crazy. I saw it in the prosecutor's file, and you do not substitute out an authenticated record with an affidavit, take that affidavit from the company and slap it on a different set of documents. No, that's not okay. What they did is not okay. And to have Theo up there in closing arguments talking about this fax header as like proof that Gutierrez knew this stuff and that there was no Brady violation, when the freaking exhibit he used, or the state used at trial, had that cut off, that's ballsy. And I'm sure maybe some non-lawyers out there are like, okay, whatever. I mean, they were the same. They all these documents did have the same source. They were all various like photocopies or versions of the same underlying documents. But the data on them was different because one shows it's a fax and one does not. And it is a big deal to take authenticated records and to submit instead, without telling anyone, without telling AT&T, without telling the court, to submit a different version of the documents. And I'm ranting because it really pisses me off. But that's what they did. So anyway, this has been Undisclosed Live. I'd like to thank Karen, our producer, who's been here every day with us, following us around. And then we forget her and run off to different directions. And we're like, oh God, where's Karen? We need to record something. And thanks to Audio Boom for helping us put this together. And we'll be back in a couple weeks with a more full-length version of what happened at the PCR hearing.
Perfect.